that he was in pain. When Goodale had been hit, he seemed to feel almost nothing, but the wound to Smith was different. He was writhing. He was in a very bad way. Perino pressed a field dressing into the wound, but blood spurted out forcefully around it. "I've got a bleeder here," Perino shouted across the street. Delta medic Sergeant Kurt Schmid dashed toward them across Marahan Road. Together, they dragged Smith back into the courtyard. Schmid tore off Smith's pants leg. When he removed the battle dressing, bright red blood projected out of the wound in a long, pulsing spurt. This was bad. The young soldier told Perino, "Man, this really hurts." The lieutenant went back out to the street and crept back up to Elliot. "Where's Smith?" Elliot asked. "He's down." "Shit," said Elliot. They saw Sergeant Ken Bourne get hit in the foot. Then Private Rodriguez rolled away from his machine gun, bleeding, screaming, and holding his crotch. He felt no pain, but when he had placed his hand on the wound, his genitals felt like mush, and blood spurted thickly between his fingers. He screamed in alarm. 8 of the 11 Rangers in Perino's Chalk 1 had now been hit. At the north end of the same block, there was a huge explosion, and in it, Stebbins went down. Nelson saw it from up close. An RPG had streaked into the wall of the house, across the alley from him, over near where Stebbins and Hurd were positioned. The grenade went off with a brilliant red flash, and tore out a chunk of the wall about 4 feet long. The concussion in the narrow alley was huge. It hurt his ears. There was a big cloud of dust. He saw, and Perino and Elliot saw from across the street, both Stebbins and Hurd flat on their backs. "They're fucked up," Nelson thought. But Stebbins stirred, and then slowly stood up, covered from head to foot in white dust, coughing, rubbing his eyes. "Get down, Stebbins," shouted Hurd. So he was okay, too. Bullets were hitting around Perino and Elliot with increasing frequency. Rounds would come in long bursts, snapping between them, over their heads, nicking the tin shed with a high-pitched ring and popping right through the metal. Rounds were kicking up dirt all over their side of the street. It was a bad position, just as Howe had foreseen.
Sir, I think that it would be a pretty good idea if we go into that courtyard," said Elliot.
"Do you really think so?" Perino asked. Elliot grabbed his arm, and they both dove for the courtyard, where Schmid was working frantically to save Smith. Corporal Smith was alert and terrified and in sharp pain. The medic had first tried applying direct pressure on the wound, which had proved excruciatingly painful and obviously ineffective. Bright red blood continued to gush from the hole in Smith's leg. The medic tried jamming Curlex into the hole. Then he checked Smith over. "Are you hurt anywhere else?" he asked.
"I don't know."
Schmid checked for an exit wound and found none. The medic was 31. He'd grown up an army brat, vowing never to join the military, and ended up enlisting a year after graduating from high school. He'd gone into special forces and elected to become a medic because he figured it would give him a good employment opportunity when he left the army. He was good at it, and his training kept progressing. By now, he'd been schooled as thoroughly as any physician's assistant, and better than some. As part of his training, he'd worked in the emergency room of a hospital in San Diego, and had even done some minor surgery under a physician's guidance. He certainly had enough training to know that Jamie Smith was in trouble if he couldn't stop the bleeding. He could deduce the path the bullet had taken. It had entered Smith's thigh and traveled up into his pelvis. A gunshot wound to the pelvis is one of the worst. The aorta splits low in the abdomen, forming the left and right iliac arteries. As the iliac artery emerges from the pelvis, it branches into the exterior and deep femoral arteries, the primary avenues for blood to the lower half of the body. The bullet had clearly pierced one of the femoral vessels. Schmid applied direct pressure to Smith's abdomen, right above the pelvis where the artery splits. He explained what he was doing.
He'd already run 2 IVs into Smith's arm, using 14-gauge large-bore needles, and was literally squeezing the plastic bag to push replacement fluid into him. Smith's blood formed an oily pool that shone dully on the dirt floor of the courtyard. The medic took comfort in the assumption that help would arrive shortly. Another treatment tactic, a very risky one, would be to begin directly transfusing Smith. Blood transfusions were rarely done on the battlefield. It was a tricky business. The medics carried IV fluids with them, but not blood. If he wanted to transfuse Smith, he'd have to find someone with the same blood type and attempt a direct transfusion. This was likely to create more problems. He could begin reacting badly to the transfusion. Schmid decided not to attempt it. The rescue convoy was supposed to be arriving shortly. What this ranger needed was a doctor, pronto. Perino radioed Captain Steele.
"We can't go any further, sir. We have more wounded than I can carry."
"You've got to push on," Steele told him.
"We cannot go further," Perino said. "Request permission to occupy a building."
Steele told Perino to keep trying. Actually, inside the courtyard, they were only about 50 feet from Lieutenant Di Tommaso and the CSAR force. But Perino had no way of knowing that. He tried to reach Di Tommaso on his radio.
"Tom, where are you?"
Di Tommaso tried to explain their position, pointing out landmarks.
"I can't see," said Perino. "I'm in a courtyard."
Di Tommaso popped a red smoke grenade, and Perino saw the red plume drifting up in the darkening sky. He guessed from the drift of the plume that they were about 50 yards apart, which in this killing zone was a great distance. On the radio, Steele kept pushing him to link up with Di Tommaso.
"They need your help," he said. "Look, sir, I've got 3 guys left, counting myself. How can I help him?"
Finally, Steele relented.
"Roger, strongpoint the building and defend it."
Schmid was still working frantically on Smith's wound. He'd asked Perino to help him by applying pressure just over the wound so he could use his hands. Perino pushed 2 fingers directly into the wound up to his knuckles. Smith screamed, and blood shot out at the lieutenant, who swallowed hard and applied more pressure. He felt dizzy. The spurts of blood continued.
"Oh, shit! Oh, shit! I'm gonna die! I'm gonna die!" Smith shouted.
He knew he had an arterial bleed. The medic talked to him, tried to calm him down. The only way to stop the bleeding was to find the severed femoral artery and clamp it. Otherwise, it was like trying to stanch a fire hose by pushing down on it through a mattress. He told Smith to lean back.
"This is going to be very painful," Schmid told the ranger apologetically. "I'm going to have to cause you more pain, but I have to do this to help you."
"Give me some morphine for the pain," Smith demanded. He was still very alert and engaged.
"I can't," Schmid told him.
In this state, morphine could kill him. After losing so much blood, his pressure was precariously low. Morphine would further lower his heart rate and slow his respiration, exactly what he did not need. The young ranger bellowed as the medic reached with both hands and tore open the entrance wound. Schmid tried to shut out the fact that there were live nerve endings beneath his fingers. It was hard. He had formed an emotional bond with Smith. They were in this together. But to save the young ranger, he had to treat him like an inanimate object, a machine that was broken and needed fixing. He continued to root for the artery. If he failed to find it, Smith would probably die. He picked through the open upper thigh, reaching up to his pelvis, parting layers of skin, fat, muscle, and vessel, probing through pools of bright red blood. He couldn't find it. Once severed, the upper end of the artery had evidently retracted up into Smith's abdomen. The medic stopped. Smith was lapsing into shock. The only recourse now would be to cut into the abdomen and hunt for the severed artery and clamp it. But that would mean still more pain and blood loss. Every time he reached into the wound, Smith lost more blood.
Schmid and Perino were covered with it. Blood was everywhere. It was hard to believe Smith had any more to lose.
"It hurts really bad," he kept saying. "It really hurts."
In time, his words and movements came slowly, labored. He was in shock. Schmid was beside himself. He had squeezed 6 liters of fluid into the young ranger and was running out of bags. He had tried everything and was feeling desperate and frustrated and angry. He had to leave the room. He got one of the other men to continue applying pressure on the wound and walked out to confer with Perino. Both men were covered with Smith's blood.
"If I don't get him out of here right now, he's going to die," Schmid pleaded.
The lieutenant radioed Steele again. "Sir, we need a medevac, a little bird or something. For Corporal Smith, we need to extract him now." Steele relayed this on the command net. It was tough to get through. It was nearly 5 o'clock and growing dark. All of the vehicles had turned back to the airbase. Steele learned that there would be no relief for some time. Putting another bird down in their neighborhood was out of the question. The captain radioed Perino back and told him, for the time being, that Smith would just have to hang on. Chapter 4 Stebbins shook with fear. Having his friends around him kept him going, but that was about all it did. You could be prepared for the sights and sounds and smells of war. But the horror of it, the blood and gore and heart-rending screams of pain, the sense of death perched right on your shoulder, breathing in your ear, there was no preparation for that. Things felt balanced on an edge, threatening at any moment to spin out of control. Was this what he had wanted so badly? An old platoon sergeant had told him once, "When war starts, a soldier wants like hell to be there, but once he's there, he wants like hell to come home." Beside Stebbins, a burst of rounds hit Hurd's M60, disabling it permanently. Hurd drew his 9mm handgun and fired it. Squinting down the alley west into the setting sun, Stebbins could see the white shirts of Somali fighters. There were dozens of them. Groups would come running out and fire volleys up the alley and then duck back behind cover. Over his right shoulder, across Marahan Road and down the alley, he could hear the rescue guys hammering at the wreck, still trying to free Walcott's body. The sky overhead was getting darker, and there was still no sign of the ground convoy. They had actually seen the vehicles drive past, just a few blocks west, about an hour earlier. Where were they? Everyone dreaded the approaching darkness. One distinct advantage U.S. soldiers had, wherever they fought, was their night vision technology, their NODs, night observation devices. But they had left them back at the hangar. The NODs were worn draped around the neck when not in use, and weighed probably less than a pound. But they were clumsy, annoying, and very fragile. It was an easy choice to leave them behind on a daylight mission. Now the force faced the night, thirsty, tired, bleeding, running low on ammo, and without one of their biggest technological advantages. Stebbins, the company clerk, gazed out at the giant orange ball easing behind buildings to the west, and had visions of a pot of fresh brewed coffee out there somewhere, waiting for him. The little birds had the lay of the land well enough now to be making regular gun runs, and were doing a lot to keep at bay the Somalis crowding around the neighborhood. The tiny helicopters came swooping in at almost ground level, flying between buildings with their miniguns ablaze. It was an amazing sight. The rockets made a ripping sound and then shook the ground with their blasts. Twombly was admiring one such run when Sergeant Barton told him the pilots were still calling for more markers on the road to better outline the American positions. "You're going to take this thing," said Barton, holding up a fluorescent orange plastic triangle, "and drop it right out there," pointing to the middle of the road. Twombly didn't want to go.
There was so much lead flying through that road that it felt like suicide to venture from cover, much less run out to the middle. It crossed his mind to refuse Barton's order, but just as quickly he rejected that. If he didn't do it, somebody else would have to. That wouldn't be fair. He had volunteered to be a ranger. He couldn't back out now, just because things had gotten rough. He grabbed the orange triangle angrily, ran out a few steps, and flung it toward the center of the road. He dove back to cover.
"That won't do it," Barton shouted at him.
He explained that the rotor wash from the birds on their gun runs would blow the marker away.
"You have to secure it. Put a rock on it."
Furious now, and terribly frightened, Twombly put his head down and ran out into the road again. Nelson remembers feeling moved by his friend's courage. The second Twombly took off again, there was shooting on the street, and so much dust kicked up, Nelson couldn't see him. "That's the last time I'll ever see Twombly." But moments later, the big man from New Hampshire came clumping back in, swearing fluently, unscathed. An old man stumbled out from behind a wall, wildly firing an AK. Rangers from all three corners were pointing guns at this man, who looked frail and had a shock of white hair and a long, bushy white beard that was stained greenish on both sides of his mouth, presumably from cut. He was evidently drunk or stoned or so high that he didn't know what was happening. His rounds were so off target, the rangers watching him at first were just stunned and then laughed. The old man made a stumbling turn and fired a round into the wall, far from any targets. Twombly flattened him with a burst from his saw. They saw strange sights as the fight wore on. In the midst of cascading gunfire, Private David Floyd watched a gray dove land in the middle of Marahan Road. The bird scratched at the dirt nonchalantly and strutted a few feet up the road, seemingly oblivious to the fury around it. Then it flew away. Floyd wistfully watched it go. A donkey, pulling a wagon, wandered across the intersection up the hill, through one of the heaviest fields of fire, near where Fillmore had been killed, and crossed the road unscathed. Then came trotting back out again minutes later, clearly confused and disoriented. It was comical. Nobody could believe the donkey hadn't been hit. Ed Urich watched with pity and amazement. God loves that donkey. Closer to the wrecked helicopter, a woman kept running out into the alley, screaming and pointing toward the house at the southeast corner of the intersection where many of the wounded had been moved. No one shot at her. She was unarmed. But every time she stepped back behind cover, a wicked torrent of fire would be unleashed where she pointed. After she'd done this twice, one of the D-boys behind the tail of Super 6-1 said, "If that bitch comes back, I'm going to shoot her." Captain Coltrup nodded his approval. She did, and the D-boy shot her down on the street. Then there was the woman in a blue turban, a powerful woman with thick arms and legs who came sprinting across the road carrying a heavy basket in both arms. She was wearing a bright blue and white dress that billowed behind her as she ran. Every ranger at the intersection blasted her. Twombly, Nelson, Urich, and Stebbins all opened up. Howe fired on her from further up the hill. First, she stumbled, but kept on going. Then, as more rounds hit her, she fell, and RPGs spilled out of her basket onto the street. The shooting stopped. She had been hit by many rounds and lay in a heap in the dirt for a long moment, breathing heavily. Then the woman pulled herself up on all fours, grabbed an RPG round, and crawled. This time, the massive Ranger volley literally tore her apart. A fat 203 round blew off one of her legs. She fell in a bloody lump for a few moments, then moved again. Another massive burst of rounds rained on her, and her body came further apart. It was appalling, yet some of the rangers laughed. To Nelson, the woman no longer even looked like a human being. She'd been transformed into a monstrous, bleeding hulk, like something from a horror movie. Later, just before it got dark, he looked back over. There was a large pool of blood on the street. Blood and clothing and the basket. But the RPG rounds and what remained of the woman were gone. When the sun had slipped behind the buildings to the west, shadow fell over the alley, and it became easier for Stebbins and Hurd to find the Sammies who were shooting at them from windows and doorways. Their muzzle flashes gave their positions away clearly. Stebbins squeezed off rounds carefully, trying to conserve ammo. Hurd was shooting now with an M16. Nearly deaf, he tapped Stebbins on the shoulder and shouted, "Steb, I just want you to know in case we don't get out of this. I think you're doing a great job." Then the ground around them shook. Stebbins heard a shattering kabang, kabang, kabang. The sound of big rounds smashing into the stone wall of the corner where they had taken cover. He was engulfed in smoke. The wall that had been their shield for more than an hour began to come apart. Somebody with a big gun down the alley had zeroed in on them and was just taking down their position. After the first shattering volley, Stebbins stepped out into the alley and returned fire at the window where he had seen the muzzle flash. Then he ducked back behind his corner, took a knee, and kept placing rounds in the same place. Kabang! 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 Three more ear-shattering rounds hit the corner again, and Stebbins was knocked backward and flat on his ass. It was as though someone had pulled him from behind with a rope. He felt no pain, just a shortness of breath. The explosions, or the way he had slammed into the ground, had sucked the air right out of him. He was dazed and covered once again with white powder from the pulverized mortar of the wall. He felt angry. "The son of a bitch almost killed me." "You okay, Stebby? You okay?" asked Hurd.
"I'm fine, Brian. Good to go."
Stebbins stood up, infuriated, cursing at full throttle as he stepped back out into the alley and resumed firing at the window. Sergeant Howe, the Delta team leader, watched with amazement from further up the street. He couldn't believe the Ranger didn't have the good sense to find better cover. To Nelson, it looked like somebody had flipped a switch inside Stebbins. For the second time that hour, he thought Stebbins had been killed. But the mild-mannered office clerk bounced back up. He was a changed man, a wild animal, dancing around, shooting like a madman. Nelson, Twarmley, Barton, and Urich were all shooting now at the same window, when there came a whoosh and a cracking explosion, and both Stebbins and Hurd screamed and disappeared in a ball of flame. That's it for Brian and Stebby. Stebbins woke up flat on his back again. He had the same feeling as before, like he'd been punched in the solar plexus. He gasped for air and tasted dust and smoke. Up through the swirl, he saw a darkening blue sky and two clouds. Then Hurd's face came swimming into view. "Stebby, you okay? You okay, Stebby?"
"Yep, Brian, I'm okay," he said.
"Just let me lay here for a couple of seconds."
"Okay."
This time, as he gathered his thoughts, common sense intruded. They needed help at this spot. More of the corner had been blown away. Stebbins figured he'd been hit in the chest by stones flying off the wall, enough to knock him over and out, but not enough to penetrate his body armor and seriously hurt him. The Sammies had set up some kind of crew-served weapon, and it was going to take more than an M16 to silence it. As he got back up, he heard Barton across the alley radioing for help. Then a voice came from ear level right behind Stebbins. One of the D-boys was in the window of the corner building, the same window Nelson had fired at earlier. The voice sounded cool, like a surfer's.
"Where's this guy shooting from, dude?"
Stebbins pointed out the window.
"All right, we've got it covered. Keep your heads down."
From inside the building, the Delta marksman fired three .203 rounds, dropping them right into the targeted window. There was an enormous blast inside the building. Stebbins figured the round had detonated some kind of ammo cache, because there was a flash throughout the first floor of the building, too bright and loud for a 203 round. After that, it went dark. Black smoke poured from the window. It got quiet. Stebbins and Hurd and the guys across the alley shouted their congratulations to the D-boy for the impressive shot. Back on one knee, a little further behind the chewed-up wall, Stebbins watched some lights flick on in the distance and was reminded that they were in the middle of a big city and that in some parts of the city, life was proceeding normally. There were fires burning somewhere back toward the Olympic Hotel where they had roped in. It seemed like ages ago. He thought, now that it was dark, maybe the Sammies would all put down their weapons and go home, and he and his buddies could walk back to the hangar and call it a night. Wouldn't that be nice? A voice shouted across the intersection that everyone was to retreat back toward the bird. As darkness fell, the force was going to move indoors. One by one, the men on his corner sprinted across the intersection. Stebbins and Hurd waited their turn. The volume of fire had died down. Okay, the big part of the war is over. Stebbins then heard a whistling sound and turned in time to see what looked like a rock hurtling straight at him. It was going to hit his head. He ducked and turned his helmet toward the missile, and then he vanished in fire and light. Chapter 5 Sergeant Fales, the wounded PJ, got a radio call for a medic. They needed somebody fast across the wide intersection west of the downed helicopter. Private Rodriguez was bleeding badly from the gunshot wound to his crotch. The men were all falling back into the various casualty collection points. The medic, Kurt Schmid, was in the courtyard up the road working on Corporal Smith. No one on the other side of Marahan Road had the skills to deal with an injury as severe as Rodriguez's. Fales was propped up behind the Kevlar plates near the tail boom of the helicopter, his hastily bandaged leg stretched out useless before him. His buddy, Tim Wilkinson, who was working on some of the wounded alongside him, had been making him laugh. The two Air Force medics had long commiserated over how unlikely they were to see real combat on this deployment. Wilkinson had just tapped Fales on the shoulder as the bullets flew overhead and said, "Be careful what you wish for." Wilkinson was still working under the impression that the ground convoy, long since returned, broken and bleeding to base, was going to arrive at any moment. He felt his job was to get all the wounded patched up and on litters, ready to be loaded up as soon as the trucks arrived. When he'd instructed Fales to get on a stretcher earlier that afternoon, the master sergeant had balked. "Hey, you know the deal. Get on," Wilkinson insisted. Fales had climbed on reluctantly and had been strapped down. But as time wore on and the vehicles didn't show, Fales worked himself free of the straps, retrieved his weapon, and resumed firing. Now he heard the call from across the street. "They need a medic, Wilkie!" Bullets and RPG rounds formed a deadly barrier between their position and the men across Marahan Road. Wilkinson folded up his medical kit and moved toward the intersection. Then he stopped. If he was afraid, he had simply filed the emotion away. Ever since the rounds had peppered the inside of the helicopter, filling it with a little snowstorm of dust and debris, Wilkinson had just stopped worrying about bullets and focused on his job, which was demanding enough to block out everything else. He worked quickly and with purpose. There were more things to do than he could get done. It was as though he couldn't think about both things, about both the danger and the work. So he concentrated on the work. Now he turned to his friend and deadpanned an absurd and deliberately cinematic request. "Cover me," he said. And he ran and ran, plowing across the wide road, head down as the volume of fire suddenly surged. Wilkinson's buddies would later joke that he wasn't shot. Because he was so slow, the Sammies had all miscalculated his speed and aimed too far in front of him. To the medic, it just felt like he had willed himself safely across the street. Once inside the Delta Command Post courtyard, he began to assess the wounded, making quick triage decisions. It was obvious Rodriguez needed help first. He was bleeding heavily and very frightened. Wilkinson tried to calm him. The medic cut open Rodriguez's uniform to assess the damage. Rodriguez had been hit by a round that entered his buttock and bored straight through his pelvis, blowing off one testicle as it exited through his upper thigh. The first goal was to stop Rodriguez from bleeding out. If his femoral artery had been hit, as with Smith across the street, he knew there wasn't much chance of stopping the bleeding. Wilkinson began applying field dressings, stuffing wads of Curlex into the gaping exit wound. He wrapped the area tightly with an ace bandage. Wilkinson then slipped rubber pneumatic pants over Rodriguez's legs and pelvis and pumped them with air to apply still more pressure to the wound. The bleeding stopped. He dosed Rodriguez with morphine and started an IV to replenish fluids, which he quickly exhausted trying to get the private stabilized. He radioed over to Fales. "You guys got any more fluids?" They did. Wilkinson told them to just bag them up and toss them as far as they could in his direction. He watched across the street as one of the men there wound up for the heave and realized that this was a bad idea. He called back over and told them not to throw it. If the contents broke open or were hit by a round, they'd waste precious fluids. If the bag spilled out, he'd be stuck in the middle of Marahan Road, gathering it all up. He decided it would be better to brave the road twice at full speed than stop in the middle of it. He ran across, again moving at what seemed tortoise pace, and again arriving unscathed. The men watching from their positions, hunkered down around the intersection, were amazed at Wilkinson's bravery. Wilkinson told Fales that he would have to go back for good this time. Rodriguez was in a critical state. He needed to be taken out immediately. Wilkinson would care for him until that happened. Then, with the fluids cradled in his arms, head down, he dashed across the road for the third and last time. Again, he arrived unhurt. As he burst back into the courtyard, one of the D-boys told him, "Man, God really does love medics." It was fast growing dark. Wilkinson got help moving Rodriguez and the others into a back room. He learned then that the convoy coming to rescue them had turned back, and that they were going to be spending the night. Wilkinson sought out Captain Miller.
"Look, I've got a critical here," he said. "He needs to get out right now. The others can wait, but he needs to come out."
Miller gave him a look that said, "We're in a bad spot here. What can I say?" Chapter 6 Specialist Stebbins had his eyes closed, but he still saw bright red when the grenade exploded. He felt searing flames, and then he just felt numb. He smelled burned hair and dust and hot cordite, and he was tumbling, tumbling, mixed up with Hurd, until they both came to rest, sitting upright, staring at each other.
"Are you okay?" Hurd asked after a long moment.
"Yeah, but I don't have my weapon."
Stebbins crawled back to his position, looking for his weapon. He found it in pieces. There was a barrel, but no hand grip. The dust was still thick in the air. He could feel it up his nose and in his eyes, and could taste it. He could also taste blood. He figured he'd busted his lip. He needed another weapon. He stood up and started for the door of the courtyard where the D-boys were holed up, figuring he'd grab one of the wounded's rifles. But he fell down. He got up and took a step, and then fell down again. His left leg and foot felt like they were asleep. After falling the second time, he walked, dragging his leg, toward the courtyard. He found his buddy Hurd standing in the doorway, telling one of the D-boys,
My buddy Steb is still out there.
Stebbins put his hand on Hurd's shoulder. Brian, I'm okay.
Wilkinson grabbed hold of Stebbins, who looked a fright. He was covered with dirt and powder and dust. His pants were mostly burned off, and he was bleeding from wounds up and down his leg. He was groggy and seemed not to have noticed his injuries.
"Just let me sit down for a few minutes," Stebbins said. "I'll be okay."
The medic helped Stebbins limp into the back room where the other wounded were gathered. It was dark, and Stebbins smelled blood and sweat and urine. The RPG that had exploded outside had briefly set fire to the house, and there was a thick layer of black smoke now hanging from the ceiling about halfway to the floor. The window was open to air things out, and everyone was sitting low. There were three Somalis huddled on a couch. Rodriguez was in the corner moaning and taking short, loud, sucking breaths. He had an IV tube in his arm, and these weird inflated pants around his middle. Fucking got his dick shot off. Hurd was arguing with a medic.
"Look, I've just got a little scratch on my wrist. I'm fine. Really, I should put a bandage on it and go back."
The Somalis moved to the floor, and Wilkinson eased Stebbins down on the couch and began cutting off his left boot with a big pair of shears.
"Hey, not my boots," he complained. "What are you doing that for?"
Wilkinson slid the boot off smoothly and slowly, removing the sock at the same time, and Stebbins was shocked to see a golf ball-sized chunk of metal lodged in his foot. He realized for the first time that he'd been hit. He had noticed that his trousers looked burned and singed, and now, illuminated by the medic's white light, he saw that the blackened, flaking patches along his leg were skin. He felt no pain, just numbness. The fire from the explosion had instantly cauterized all his wounds. He could see the whole lower left side of his body was burned. One of the D-boys poked his head in the door and gestured toward the white light.
"Hey, man, you gotta turn that white light out," he said. "It's dark out there now, and we've gotta be tactful."
Stebbins was amused by that word, tactful. But then he thought about it. Tactful, tact, tactics. And it made perfect sense. Wilkinson turned off the white light and flicked on a red flashlight. Stebbins thrust his hand back into his butt pack for a cigarette and found the pack had been burned as well. Wilkinson rapped Stebbins' foot.
"You're out of action," he said. "Listen, you're numb now, but it's going to go away. All I can give you is some Percocet."
He handed Stebbins a tablet and some iodized water in a cup. Wilkinson also handed him a rifle.
"Here's a gun. You can guard this window."
"Okay.
But as your health care professional, I feel I should warn you that narcotics and firearms don't mix."
Stebbins just shook his head and smiled. He kept hearing sounds out the window coming up the alley, but there was no one there. His mind was playing tricks on him. Once or twice he shouted in panic and blasted a few rounds at the window, but it was just shadows. Stebbins' outbursts and the blast of occasional RPG hits against the outside wall roused Rodriguez from his morphine reverie. He laughed and shouted out the window what bad shots the Somalis were. As bad as his wound was, he felt no pain, just discomfort. The rubber pants had the lower half of his body in a vice. He asked Wilkinson once or twice if he could release some of the pressure. The medic said no. One of the D-boys came in and asked Stebbins where the RPG had come from that got him, which direction. Stebbins wasn't sure.
"From down the alley west," he said.
But that had been the direction he was facing, and his injuries were all on his backside. Then Stebbins remembered he had turned and looked back when he had seen it coming at him. It must have come from behind him.
"No, east. Not from over the bird, though," he said. "From further up the street."
Finally,
He was left to sit there alone, his pants blown off, clutching his rifle, listening to Rodriguez breathing steadily, and to the Somali woman complaining with words he didn't understand that her husband's flex cuffs were too tight. He realized he had to urinate badly. There was no place to go. So he just released the flow where he sat. It felt great. He looked up at the Somali family and gave them a weak smile. "Sorry about the couch," he said. Chapter 7. Still out on the street 1.5 blocks south, Private David Floyd was shooting at everything that moved. At first, he had hesitated firing into crowds when they massed downhill to the south. But he had seen the Delta guy, Fillmore, get hit, and Lieutenant Lechner, and about 3 or 4 of his other buddies. And now, he was just shooting at everybody. The world was erupting around him, and shooting back seemed the only sensible response. But no matter how many rounds he and Specialist Melvin DeJesus poured down Marahan Road, the crowds kept on creeping in. Out in the street, still flat in his little dip in the middle of the road, Specialist John Collette was doing the same. They were the southernmost point on the perimeter, and had no idea what was happening down around the crash site, or anywhere else for that matter. When Floyd hit someone with rounds from his saw, he could see their bodies begin to twitch, like they were being zapped with electricity. They would usually make it only a step or two more before falling over. A bullet or a casing or something hit him. Floyd jumped a foot. He felt down, afraid to take his eyes off the road ahead, and found that his pants had been ripped from his crotch to his boot. But the round hadn't even scratched him. It had evidently come through the tin wall. "Woo!" he said, looking over at DeJesus, grateful and frightened. His ears were ringing, but for some reason he could still hear. DeJesus was starting to freak out. He was getting jumpier and jumpier, saying he couldn't stay there anymore. He had to move. He and Floyd had felt safe for a time, pressed behind the tin shed wall on the west side of the road in shadow. But as it grew darker now, DeJesus wasn't staying low. He was up on his feet, hopping up and down. He said he had to do something. He had a bad feeling. He had to be somewhere else. Now. Floyd felt like slapping him. "Sit your ass down," he screamed at him. As it happened, across Marahan Road, men were waving them into the courtyard. Captain Steele had given up for the time being, catching up to Lieutenants Perino and Di Tommaso in the next block. He wanted all the men at this southern end of the perimeter to consolidate in the courtyard. Already, there were 3 Delta teams and a number of wounded in the small space, including Nethery and Errico, who both had gunshot wounds to their biceps, and Lechner, who was still howling with the pain of his shattered right lower leg. Goodale was still working the radio while a medic stuffed Curlex into the exit wound in his buttock. The courtyard was a haven, but the wide road that separated Floyd, DeJesus, and the other members of Chalk 3 from it loomed like an impassable gulf. One by one, they ran for it. Private George Siegler went first. Then Collette jumped up from his spot in the middle of the road and sprinted for the door. Private Jeff Young, his big glasses bouncing on his nose and long legs pumping high, made it across next. As each man ran, Floyd and DeJesus, who had settled down again, blasted rounds to the south to provide covering fire. Finally, only Floyd and DeJesus were left. "You're going to run across that road," Floyd told his buddy. DeJesus nodded. "But listen here. When you get across, don't you go through that doorway, see? You turn around and start shooting, because as soon as you're across, I'm coming. Okay?" DeJesus nodded. Floyd wasn't at all sure he'd gotten through. He must have blasted 50 rounds as DeJesus ran, and his friend didn't forget. Before entering the courtyard, DeJesus turned, dropped to one knee, and started shooting. Floyd felt like he had lead in his boots as he ran. His torn pants were flapping around him like a skirt, and he wasn't wearing any underwear, so he felt naked in more ways than one, as his legs churned up the road. It seemed like the doorway to the courtyard was actually receding while he ran. But he made it. Chapter 8 Across the city, back at the Rangers airfield base an hour or so earlier, the truckloads of injured and dead off the lost convoy had arrived. This was the kind of catastrophe Major Rob Marsh had long planned for, hoping he would never see. He had entered the Army in 1976 as a Special Forces medic, and then had gone on to medical school at the University of Virginia. His father, John Marsh, was then Secretary of the Army. Marsh was working as a flight surgeon in Texas when he met General Garrison. The two had hit it off. A few years later, as Delta commander, Garrison invited Marsh to be the unit's surgeon, no doubt mindful of the family connection. Marsh said no, fearing that the offer might have more to do with his father than his medical skills. But when the offer was renewed about a year later, he'd accepted. He'd been doctoring for the unit ever since, 8 years now. One of Marsh's proudest innovations were four large trauma chests, 4-by-2-foot trunks, packed with IV fluid bags, gauze, Curlex, petroleum jelly, needles, chest tubes, all the things needed for initial treatment of wounds. Instead of just filling the chests with the equipment, Marsh and his staff had packaged 15 separate Ziploc bags in each trunk. 5 serious wound packets, and 10 for lesser wounds. The idea was to assess the seriousness of an injury, then grab the appropriate packet. Marsh had seen British forces do that during the Falkland Islands War. Delta had been lugging the trunks around with them now for years, but not always happily. Officers had complained about how much space the trunks took up on pallets, and more than once had tried to have them removed. In Marsh's experience, it was always officers with actual combat experience, like Garrison, who would step in to save his chests. Now, for the first time, they needed them. Marsh had been hovering around the JOC all afternoon as the mission deteriorated. At first, Garrison had been in the back of the room, chewing on his unlit cigar, listening and watching quietly. He was not one to interfere. Some top commanders insisted on calling most of the shots themselves, but Garrison wasn't like that. When they'd begun this deployment, the general had given a little speech, explaining that, for the first time in his career, he'd been given command of men he felt he didn't need to lead. They knew how to lead themselves. Garrison told them his job was just to supply them with what they needed and stay out of their way. But as things began going wrong, the general had moved to the front of the room. Marsh had to leave the JOC to tend to Private Blackburn, who had not, as the medic had feared, broken his neck when he fell from the Black Hawk. The young ranger had suffered head and neck trauma and had a few broken bones. Marsh was working on him when he got word that a Black Hawk was down in the city. When he returned to peek into the JOC, there was an anxious buzz about the place. Commanders seemed fixated on the TV screens. Garrison was fully engaged. Things had clearly gone amok. The Army Field Hospital at the U.S. Embassy was alerted to be ready for casualties. There was some discussion about sending men directly there, but it was decided to do the primary care at Marsh's tent. He was ready. He had 2 surgeons, a nurse anesthetist, and 2 physician assistants. Nurses from the adjacent Air Force Mobile Surgical Facility also volunteered to help. There would be a triage area just outside the tent. The most urgent cases would go directly inside. Those who could wait would go to a holding area out back. Those who were expectant, near death and beyond help, would go to a separate spot near the ambulance, away from the other wounded. Marsh had designated his unit's ambulance for the dead. It was cool in there. The bodies would be out of the sun and out of view. Pilla's body was already there.
When the convoy pulled up, it was like a scene out of some nightmarish medieval painting. The back of one of the 5 tons opened on a mass of bleeding, wailing, moaning men. Griz Martin sat to one side, holding his entrails in his hands, his legs shattered, awake but groggy. There hadn't even been time in most cases for the wounds to have been bandaged. Marsh had just seconds to make a judgment call on each as the litter bearers lifted them out. Private Adalberto Rodriguez, who had been blown up and run over, went into the tent. A Delta sergeant, whose left calf had been shot off, went out back to wait. Into the tent went Sergeant Ruiz, who had a sucking wound in his chest. Some of the wounded Rangers were dazed. They wandered around the triage area, sputtering angrily. Marsh noted they all were still carrying weapons. He asked the chaplain to start gathering those guys and talking to them. Delta medic Sergeant First Class Don Hutchinson confronted Marsh about Griz. Hutch and Griz were close. "He's hurt real bad, Doc." Some of the other D-boys had come over to be with Griz, who was semi-conscious with what Marsh recognized as a clearly non-survivable injury. His midsection was basically gone, and when Marsh tried to turn him over, he saw the whole back of his pelvis had been blown off. Griz was in shock level 3, going into 4. His skin was pasty pale. He'd obviously lost a tremendous amount of blood. It was amazing that he was still alive, much less semi-conscious. But when Marsh took his hand, Griz gripped it as hard as the doctor's hand had ever been gripped. He should have labeled him expectant or certain to die, and sent him back by the ambulance. But with all the guys from the unit pressing in, urging him to do something, Marsh felt compelled to act. He felt sure it was hopeless, but they'd give Griz a full court press anyway. Marsh sent into the tent Private Kovaleski, the Ranger driver whose torso had been penetrated by the unexploded RPG. Amazingly, he still had vital signs. Inside, Captain Bruce Adams, a general surgeon, examined the broken body of the soldier and recoiled at what he found. Kovaleski's left arm was gone. One of the Air Force nurses would find it, to her horror, in his pants pocket, where a specialist hand had placed it. Adams began working to restore Kovaleski's breathing, while a nurse removed his clothing. They found the entrance wound of the RPG on one side of his chest, and lifting a flap of skin under his right arm, Adams saw the tapered front end of the grenade. Marsh came by for a quick second assessment and told Adams, "This guy's expectant. Don't waste any more time on him." Assigned to help carry the nearly dead man back out was Sergeant First Class Randy Rimes, a munitions expert. It was Rimes who recognized that Kovaleski had a live bomb embedded in his chest. The detonator was on the tip, just under his right arm. Instead of taking him out by the ambulance, Rimes and another soldier built a sandbag bunker and placed Kovaleski's body inside it. Rimes then stretched out beside the bunker on his stomach and reached his hand around to delicately remove the tip of the grenade from under the man's skin. While all this was going on, commanders inside the JOC had watched with horror as triumphant Somalis overran the site of the second Black Hawk crash, pilot Mike Durance, and were now getting frantic calls for a chopper to medevac Smith and Carlos Rodriguez from the first crash site. They had 99 men pinned down in the city and no rescue force on its way. They knew it would be foolhardy to try to put another Black Hawk down there to evacuate the 2 badly injured Rangers. The volume of fire was much heavier there than anywhere else in Mogadishu, and the Somalis had already shot down 4 Black Hawks. Garrison had pilots who were willing to try, but there was no point in getting more men killed trying to save 2. It had been easy to believe, prior to this day, that the Somali warlord ID'd lacked broad popular support. But this fight had turned into something akin to a popular uprising.
It seemed like everybody in the city wanted suddenly to help kill Americans. There were burning roadblocks everywhere. It was obvious Ideed and his clan had been waiting for the right moment, and this was it. At the second crash site, seen from high overhead, there was no sign of Shugart, Gordon, Durant, or the Super 6-2 crew, only busy crowds of excited skinnies still swarming over the wreckage. There was a brief flurry of hope when the observation birds picked up tracking beacons from Durant's and his co-pilot Ray Frank's flight suits. But it was quickly dashed when it became apparent that the beacons had been stripped from the pilots by canny ID'd militia and were being run all over the city to confuse the airborne search. As for the men around the first crash site, they would be all right. Those 99 were some of the toughest soldiers in the world. They were superbly trained, well-armed, and mean as hell. They owned that neighborhood, and nobody was going to take it away from them. Certainly no armed force in Mogadishu. Unless they ran out of ammo, that is, or keeled over from dehydration. The C-2 helicopter had begun calling for help shortly before dusk.
"Need a resupply. IV bags, ammo, and water. Obviously, we need them to hurry as fast as they can. Our boys on the ground are running out of bullets."
"Romeo 6-4.
"Harrell."
"This is Adam 6-4.
"Garrison."
"You want us to put resupply on a helo?"
"If you can, put resupply on a helo. Try to take it out to the northern crash site. They're running out of ammo, IV bottles, and water. Over."
Few of the Rangers had even bothered to take full canteens. They had been running and fighting now in sweltering heat for several hours. If they were going to make it through the night, they would need more than skill and willpower. So even though it risked turning a bad situation worse, Garrison ordered a Black Hawk in. They could drop water and ammo and medical supplies, and if possible, land and pull the two critical Rangers out. In the JOC, most of the officers believed the helicopter would be shot out of the sky. It would most likely crash land right there on Marahan Road. Either way, the men on the ground would get their ammo and water. Blackhawk Super 6-6, piloted by Chief Warrant Officers Stan Wood and Gary Fuller, moved down through the night just after 7 o'clock, guided by infrared strobe lights set out on the wide street just south of the crash site. As the helicopter descended, machine gun fire erupted again from points all around the Ranger perimeter, and RPGs flew. The men inside courtyards and houses were startled by how close the gunfire was to their positions, in some cases on the other side of the walls. The rotor wash from the Black Hawk kicked up a furious sandstorm. It hovered for about 30 seconds, which was about 28 seconds too long as far as Sergeant Howe was concerned. He held his breath as the deafening bird hung over the block, afraid that it was going to pancake in on them. Delta Sergeant First Class Alex Zagetti, who had survived the lost convoy earlier that afternoon, now hustled in the back of the helicopter with another operator to shove the kit bags filled with water, ammo, and IV bags overboard. The helicopter was getting riddled. Zagetti was hit in the face. Bullets poked holes in the rotor blades in the engine, which began sprouting fluids. One round passed through the transmission gearbox. Super 6-6 kept flying. As it pulled up and away, men scurried out of the buildings to retrieve the new supplies. Back in the JOC, they heard Wood announce calmly,
"Resupply is complete."
The stranded force had been tucked in for the night. Chapter 9. The fight now raged around 3 blocks of Mogadishu real estate. The block immediately south of the crash was occupied in 2 places. The CSAR team and Lieutenant DiTomaso's Chalk 2 Rangers, about 33 men in all, had moved in through the wall knocked over by Super 6-1 on its way down. They had begun spreading out to adjacent rooms and courtyards to the south. Abdiaziz Ali Aden was still hiding in one of those back rooms.
Lieutenant Perino had led his men into a courtyard on the same block, through a door on the east side of Marahan Road. He and about 8 other soldiers were grouped where Sergeant Schmid was still working on Corporal Smith, who was slowly fading away. Perino still wasn't sure where the downed bird was or how close they were to Di Tommaso, although they were separated now by only a few feet. Captain Miller and his contingent of D-boys and wounded rangers were in the courtyard Howe had cleared on the west side of Marahan Road. Miller's 25 men had spread out into that block, moving into rooms off the courtyard. The